Most 10 minutes. Would Kate keep her promise? The clerk returned. He wore a blank, unreadable expression. The seller would like to speak with you. He waited. What David wouldn't have given for a gun at that moment. He simply nodded and stepped behind the desk. The clerk pulled the cloth back and pushed David into the darkness. He could sense the clerk reaching over his back, toward his head, but before David could turn, the clerk's arm was coming down toward his chest, fast. Chapter 101. David turned just as the clerk's hand came down. Light flashed all around him. Above, a single light bulb swayed back and forth. The clerk held the string cord in his hand. "The phone is just there," he said, motioning toward a table in the corner. The phone receiver was made of molded thick plastic, like the ones in phone booths in the 80s, the type that could bludgeon someone to death. The phone was just as old, a rotary dial. David walked to the table and picked up the handset. He pivoted his body to face the clerk. The man had taken a step toward him. The line sounded dead. "Central?" David said. "Identify," a voice said. "Vale, David Patrick." "Station?" "Jakarta," David said. He couldn't quite remember, but he knew it didn't go this way. "Stand by." The line went dead again. "Access code?" Access code. There was no access code. This wasn't a Boy Scout's secret hideout. They should have voice print identified him the second he'd said his name, unless they were playing for time, surrounding the building. David tried to get a read on the clerk as he held the phone. How long had he been inside? Almost 15 minutes by now? "I don't have an access code." "Hold the line," the voice returned. "More nervous? Give a name?" David considered the request. What did he have to lose? "Reed, Andrew Michael." The response was quick. "Hold for the director." 2 seconds passed, and then Howard Keegan's grandfatherly voice was on the line. "David, my God, we've been looking everywhere for you. Are you all right? What's your status?" "Is the line secure?" "No, but frankly, my boy, we've got bigger problems at the moment." "Clock tower?" "Fallen. But not broken. I'm organizing a counter-strike. There's another problem. A plague is sweeping the globe. We're racing the clock here. I think I have a piece of the puzzle." "What is it?" "I'm not sure yet. I need transport."
"Destination?"
"Gibraltar."
"Gibraltar?"
Keegan sounded confused. "Is that a problem?"
"No, it's the best news I've heard. I'm actually in Gibraltar now. The last of the agents and I are planning a counter-strike on the Amari headquarters here. The clerk can arrange transport for you. But before you go, there's something else I need to tell you, David. Something I want you to know, just in case you don't make it here, or if I'm not here when you arrive. You weren't the only one investigating Amari. Unraveling their conspiracy has been my life's work. But when I ran out of time, I knew you were my best shot at stopping them. I was your source. I used all my contacts within Amari to help you, but it wasn't enough. The tactical mistakes are mine alone, and are in the past. We have new information, possibly something we can use. This is not over. I'll see you in Gibraltar."
Chapter 102. Amari Research Base Prism, East Antarctica. Dorian had to hand it to Martin Gray. The man was technically competent. The research site in Antarctica was breathtaking. For the last 30 minutes, Martin had walked Dorian through each section of the giant, centipede-esque mobile laboratory. The primate lab, with its 2 dead carcasses, the drill control center, the staff barracks, the conference rooms, and the main control center, where they sat now.
"We're out in the open here, Dorian. We should take precautions. There are several research stations here in Antarctica. Any one of them could stumble across us."
"And do what?" Dorian said. "Who are they going to call?"
"The nations that fund them, for one."
"Those nations will soon be consumed with the outbreak.
Unauthorized research on some ice cube at the end of the world won't be on their radar, trust me. Let's stop wasting time and get down to business. Tell me what you found at the subsite.
About what we expected.
Him?
No. General Kane. Martin seemed to wince as he said the word. Wasn't among the bodies we
Then he's inside. Dorian's hope betrayed his usual stoic exterior.
Not necessarily. There are other possibilities.
Doubtful. Martin pressed on.
He could have been killed during the raid in Tibet, or en route. It was a long journey, or...
He's inside. I know it.
If so, it raises several questions. Specifically, why he hasn't exited, and why we haven't heard from him. And there's the reality of the timeline.
Kane left for Antarctica in 1938, 75 years ago. If he is inside, he would be over 120 years old. Long dead.
Maybe he did try to communicate with us.
Roswell. A warning.
Martin thought it over. Interesting. Even so, your obsession with Kane, with finding him, puts us all in danger. You need a clear head if you're to lead this operation.
My head is clear, Martin.
Dorian stood.
I admit I'm obsessed with finding Conrad Kane.
But you would be too if your father had gone missing.
Chapter 103. Robert Hunt left the snowmobile running. He dismounted and walked under the small rock overhang where he'd left the two men. They were gone. But one snowmobile was there. Had they gone on to the site? Reported him? Had they followed him, backtracking to the last site? That would be as good as reporting him. He ran out into the open field of ice, withdrew his binoculars, and scanned the distance in every direction. Nothing. He walked back to the cave. It was cold inside. Deathly cold. He tried to turn the stranded snowmobile on, but it was out of gas. How? Had they followed him and barely made it back? No. The tracks were old. They had run it here in the cave.
Why? To keep warm?
Yes, probably. They had waited as long as they could until it sputtered out and the warmth receded. Then they had climbed on the last snowmobile and left together. But where had they gone? Chapter 104. Amari Research Base Prism, East Antarctica.
I beg you not to do this, Dorian.
Martin stepped in front of the door and spread his arms.
Be reasonable, Martin. You know the time has come.
We don't know that...
What we do know is that a huge chunk of their city has broken off, and that one of their bells was activated almost 75 years ago. We have the bodies from the sub as proof.
You want to take the risk? We both know they'll come out of hibernation soon, if they haven't already. We don't have time to research and debate. If they march out of there, the human race is finished.
You assume
I know it. You know it. We've seen what the bell can do, and that's just the porch light over the stoop. The doorway to the type of city we won't be capable of building for thousands of years, assuming we're even capable of inventing technology on their scale. Imagine what weapons they have in there. The bell is simply a bug zapper to keep the beasts from disturbing their rest. They don't want anyone inside there for a reason. I'm ensuring our survival. This is the only way.
An act of this magnitude, based upon so much conjecture.
Great leaders are forged from the fire of hard decisions, Dorian said. Now stand aside. Inside the cell, Dorian knelt down to look the two Indonesian children in the face. They sat on a white bench just outside the primate lab. Their feet dangled a few inches above the ground.
I bet you two are glad to be out of those suits, aren't you?
The boys just stared at him.
My name is Dorian Sloane. What are your names?
The boys' eyes were a blank stare that drifted slowly from Dorian to the floor.
That's okay. We don't need names to play this game.
The name game is boring anyway. We're going to play a better game, a very fun game. Have you ever played hide and seek? It was my favorite game as a child. I was very good at it. He turned to his assistant. Get the packs from Dr. Chase. Dorian fixed the boys with a stare. We're going to put you inside a maze, a giant maze. Your job is to find a certain room. Dorian held out a picture. You see this? This is a room with a lot of glass tubes in it. Tubes big enough to hold a man. Can you believe it? If you can find this room and hide in it, you're going to win the prize. Dorian laid the glossy printout on their laps. It was a computer rendering, an extrapolation of what the Amari thought a large tube room might look like. The boys each studied it.
What prize?
One of them asked. Dorian spread his hands.
That would be my question, too. My, you're clever, so very clever.
Dorian looked around. What prize, indeed? He hadn't thought they would ask. He hated kids, almost as much as their questions.
We actually have several prizes. What prize would you like?
The other boy put the printout on the bench.
Kate? You want to see Kate?
Dorian said. Both boys nodded, matching the rhythmic motion of their dangling legs.
Well, I tell you what. If you find that room and hide there and wait, Kate will come and find you.
Dorian nodded when the boy's eyes got bigger.
That's right. I know Kate. We're old friends, actually.
Dorian smiled to himself for the inside joke, but the grin had the desired effect. The boys bounced subtly on the bench, excited. A lab assistant entered with the packs.
Here they are, sir.
He helped Dorian put the packs on the children. The snap activates the warheads. We've tried our best to make them tamper-resistant. If the snaps are disconnected, the warheads will detonate. As you requested, once they're activated, there's no manual or remote deactivation. We set the countdown for 5 hours.
Excellent work.
Dorian snapped the chest straps tight. He held the boys by the shoulders.
Now, this is a very important part of the game. You can't take these packs off. If you do, the game is over. No prize. No Kate.
I know they're kind of heavy, and you can stop to rest if you need to, but remember, if you take them off, no Kate.
And there's one last thing.
Dorian pulled out an envelope and pinned it to the taller boy's chest. It had large script letters that read, Papa. Dorian put a few more pins in the envelope, ensuring it wouldn't move.
If you see a man inside, an older man in a military uniform, you win the game. If you give him this envelope. So if you see him, you run to him and tell him that Dieter sent you. Can you remember that?
The boys nodded.
15 minutes later, Dorian watched from the command center as the two boys waddled toward the bell, almost 2 miles below the lab. The deadly device didn't so much as flicker. Ahead of them, a giant iron portal door opened in layers. Like a reptile's eyelid, Dorian thought. He watched the monitors which showed the camera feeds from the boys' suits. Each video panned upward as the boys looked up at the bell several hundred yards above them, hanging there in the massive dome of ice. Dorian clicked a button.
It's not going to hurt you. Just go on in. Remember the room with the tubes.
He released the button and turned to the tech in the command center.
Can you put the computer image of the tubes on their suit display?
Good. He activated the link to the boys' suits again.
There it is. Go in and find the tubes.
Dorian sat back in the chair and watched the boys walk through the portal doors. Their camera feeds turned to static as the portal doors closed. On the other screens in the control room, Dorian could see the outside chamber and the bell. The domed entryway was still. And dead quiet. On the wall of screens, a digital readout ticked off the seconds of the countdown. 4 hours, 23 minutes, 57 seconds. 4 hours, 23 minutes, 56 seconds. 4 hours, 23 minutes, 55 seconds. Chapter 105. Transcript
White House press briefing regarding the flash flu outbreak. Adam Rice, White House press secretary.
Good morning, everyone. I'm going to read a brief statement, then I'll take a few questions. The president and his administration are taking steps to assess and address the health concern the media is referring to as the flash flu. Earlier today, the president ordered the CDC to dedicate all available resources to assessing the threat. Pending the results of that assessment, the White House may take further actions to ensure every American's safety. Rice sets the statement down and points at the first reporter. Reporter, has the president set a timetable for closing the borders?
Rice exhales and looks off camera.
Rice, the president has said repeatedly that closing the borders is a last resort. We know what the impact would be on American businesses, both large and small. Look, we understand there's a public health issue here, but there's also an economic risk. Closing the borders poses a very real risk to the American economy. The flu may affect many Americans, but closing the borders would definitely cause an immediate recession that would endanger more Americans, especially those at or below the poverty level, than a flu outbreak. We're taking a balanced approach here. The president is not going to put anyone at risk, whether it's at the hands of the flu or a trade recession.
Reporter, what's your official response to the reports from Asia, the Middle East, and Europe?
Rice, we're taking them seriously, but we're also conducting a careful, balanced review of the information. We're still working with incomplete information, and frankly, we don't think all of it is reliable.
Reporter, are you referring to the eyewitness reports, the videos?
Rice holds up a hand.
Rice, look, as for the videos on the internet, it's one of those things, you know, where you're going to see the worst. No one makes a YouTube video about themselves sitting at home, healthy as can be, eating cereal or doing aerobics. They, you know, make these videos when there's something sensational. We've all seen them at this point, and there are going to be more of them. If you live your life based on what you see on YouTube, you're going to make some pretty poor decisions. And that's what we're trying to avoid here. It's not even clear if these videos are real, and if they are, they could be related to any number of acute health issues.
Rice holds both arms up.
Rice. Okay, that's it for today. Thank you all.
Chapter 106. Clock Tower Safe House, Gibraltar. The sunset over the Bay of Gibraltar was breathtaking. Soft shades of red, orange, and pink met the deep blue water of the Atlantic in the distance. About 100 yards away, the harbor ended and the rock rose out of the sea and land. Its gray and black clashed with the burning rays of sunlight sliding down its side. Kate pulled the glass door back and walked out onto the tile-covered porch 4 stories above the streets of the harbor. Below her, armed guards patrolled the large house. A warm Mediterranean breeze engulfed her, and Kate leaned against the rail. Behind her, she heard a wave of laughter erupt around the table. David's eyes met hers. He looked so happy there, sitting among the dozen other Clock Tower station chiefs and agents, the survivors of the fall of Clock Tower, now the Resistance. From out here, if she didn't know any better, she'd think it was just a reunion of old college friends, kidding, sharing stories, and planning tomorrow's escapades for tailgating and a big football game. But she knew they were making plans for the assault on Imari Gibraltar's headquarters. The conversation had veered into technical discussions of tactics, debates about the building's layout, and questions about whether the schematics and other intel they had were reliable. Kate had drifted out onto the porch, like a new girlfriend who clearly wasn't part of the core group. On the plane ride from India, she and David had talked openly, for the first time without any guards or hesitation. She told him about losing her child, how she met a man who disappeared into thin air at almost the moment she'd gotten pregnant. She left San Francisco for Jakarta a week after the miscarriage, and she had thrown herself into her work and autism research in the years that followed. David had been just as forthcoming. He had told Kate about his fiancée dying in the 9/11 attacks, and how he was badly injured, almost paralyzed. Then about his recovery and his decision to dedicate himself to finding the people responsible.
A week ago, Kate would have brushed off his assertions about the Amari and a global conspiracy. But on the plane, she had just nodded. She didn't know how the pieces fit together, but she believed him. They had slept after they talked, as if the release had brought the respite. But for Kate, it was a sporadic, restless slumber, mostly because of the plane's noise, and partly because it was hard to sleep in the chair. Every time Kate awoke, David was always asleep. She imagined he did the same, watching her until he fell asleep again. She still had so much to say to him. When she woke up the last time, the plane was making its final approach at the Gibraltar airfield. David gazed out the plane window, and when he saw that Kate was awake, he said, "Remember, don't say anything about the journal, Tibet, or the China facility until we know more. I'm still not sure about this." Clock tower agents swarmed the plane the second they landed, and they were whisked away to the home. She and David had barely said a word since. Behind her, the door slid open, and Kate turned quickly, smiling, hoping. It was Howard Keegan, the director of Clock Tower. Kate's smile faded instantly, and she hoped the man hadn't seen it. He stepped out and closed the door. "May I join you, Dr. Warner?"
"Please, and call me Kate."
Keegan stood beside her at the rail, not leaning and not looking at Kate. He stared out into the darkening bay. He was clearly in his 60s, but he was fit, robust. The silence was a bit awkward.
"How's the planning going?" Kate asked.
"Well, though it won't matter." Keegan's voice was flat, emotionless.
A chill ran through Kate. She tried to lighten the mood.
"You're that confident?"
"I am. Tomorrow's outcome has been planned for years now."
He motioned to the streets and the guards below.
"Those aren't clock tower agents. They're Imari security, as are the guards inside. Tomorrow, the last of the non-Imari agents within clock tower will die, including David."
Kate pushed off the rail and looked back at the table where the men were still laughing and pointing.
Don't turn around. I'm here to make you an offer."
Keegan's voice was a whisper.
"For what?"
"His life. In exchange for yours. You will leave here tonight, in a few hours, when everyone has knocked off. They'll go to bed early. The raid is at dawn."
"You're lying."
"Am I? I don't want to kill him. I'm genuinely fond of him. We're just on different sides of the coin. Chance. But we want you, badly."
"Why?"
"You survived the bell. It's the key to everything we've done. We have to understand it. I won't lie, you'll be questioned, then studied. But he will be spared. Look at your options. We can simply kill those agents inside right now. It's messier here in a residential neighborhood, but acceptable. We've held this operation open too long as it is, waiting, seeing who would come in, hoping he would call. There's more. If you're clever in your negotiations, you may be able to free the children, or perhaps trade yourself for them. They're being held at the same facility."
Keegan looked Kate in the eyes.
"Now, what's your answer?"
She swallowed and nodded.
"Okay.
There's one more thing. From the recordings on the plane, you and Vale mention a journal. We want it. We've been looking for it for a very long time."
Chapter 107. Snow Camp Alpha, Drill Site Number 7, East Antarctica. A surge of relief swept over Robert Hunt when he saw the snowmobile parked outside the small, white-walled barracks at Drill Site 7. He parked his snowmobile and ran inside. The men were warming themselves beside the wall heater. Both rose when he entered.
"We tried to wait, but we were freezing. We couldn't stay."
"I know. It's okay," Robert said.
He surveyed the room, exactly like the last six. He glanced over at the radio.
"Have they called?"
"Three times, on the hour, asking for you. They're losing patience."
Robert thought about what to say.
"What did you tell them?"
The answer would tell him where they shook out in all this.
"We didn't answer the first call.
The second said they were sending backup. We told them you were working on the drill, and we needed no assistance.
What did you see?
The last question sent Robert's mind racing.
What if they're testing me? What if they talk to the employer and they have orders to kill me? Can I trust them?
I didn't. Winter started. Look, I ain't no genius. Hell, I didn't even graduate high school, but I've worked an oil rig in the Gulf my whole life, and I know we ain't drilling for oil. So why don't you tell us what you saw?
Robert sat at the small table with the radio. He suddenly felt so tired and hungry. He pulled his hood off, then his gloves.
I'm still not sure.
There were monkeys. They killed them with something. Then I saw kids in a glass cage.
Chapter 108. Clock Tower Safe House, Gibraltar. Kate tried to estimate the distance between the balconies. 4 feet? 5 feet? Could she make it? Below, she heard a guard walking by, and she crept back into her room. She listened. The crunch of fine gravel under the man's feet slowly faded into the distance. She returned to the balcony. She stepped to the edge and put one leg over, straddling the rail, then cartwheeled the other leg over. She stood on the tiny lip outside the rails, which she held with both hands behind her back. Could she make it? She reached a leg out, holding the rail with one hand, like a ballet dancer in a lunge during a high note. She extended as far as she could, felt her grip slipping on the rail, and almost fell. She reeled back just in time and slammed back into the rail. She was going to break her neck. The other balcony was just out of reach, less than 2 feet. She leaned back against the rail and was about to jump for it when the door on the other balcony slid open and David walked out. He drew back at the first sight of her, but then, after recognizing her, he walked to the rail. He smiled at her.
How romantic.
He held out his good arm.
Jump. I'll pull you up. I owe you one.
Kate glanced down. She could feel the sweat on her hands. David held his arm out over the rail. It was a few feet from her. She wanted to leap to him, but could she make it? If she fell, the guards would be on her, and Keegan would know instantly. The deal would be off. Could David catch her? Could he get them out of this? She trusted him, believed in him, but... She jumped, and he caught her and pulled her over the rail and into his arms. Then it all happened so fast, like a dream. He swept her into the room, not bothering to close the door. He tossed her on the bed and climbed on top of her. He pulled his shirt off and ran his hands through her hair. He kissed her on the mouth and pulled her shirt up, only lifting his face from hers long enough to pull the shirt past her face. She had to tell him, had to stop it, but she couldn't resist. She wanted this. His touch was like an electric current, lighting up parts of her that had long ago gone dark. He was awakening something like a supernatural force that overwhelmed her, blotting everything else out. She couldn't think. Her bra was off, and his pants were coming off. It felt so good. The release. They could talk after. Kate watched David's chest rise and fall. It was a deep sleep. She made her decision. She lay back on the bed, staring at the white plaster ceiling, deliberating, trying to understand what she was feeling. She felt alive again, whole, safe even despite Keegan's threat. A part of her wanted to wake David, to tell him they were in danger and that they needed to get out of there. But what could he do? The bullet wounds in his leg and shoulder weren't even half healed. She would only get him killed. She put her clothes back on and quietly exited his room, slowly closing the door.
I was clear.
The voice frightened her. She turned. Keegan, standing behind her, wearing an expression of sadness, disappointment, regret.
I haven't told him. I doubt that it's true.
Kate cracked the door, revealing David lying on his back, a sheet covering only his lower body. Kate gently eased the door back.
We didn't talk at all.
She looked down. I was saying goodbye. 30 minutes later, Kate watched the lights of North Africa out of the window as the plane flew south toward Antarctica. Chapter 109.
David, wake up. David opened his eyes. He was still naked, lying in the same place where he'd fallen asleep. He felt the bed beside him. Empty. Cold. Kate had been gone for hours. David? Howard Keegan stood over him. David sat up.
What is it? What time is it?
His former mentor handed him a note. It's around 2 a.m. We found this note in Kate's room. She's gone. David opened the note.
Dear David, don't hate me. I have to try to make a trade for the children. I know you're attacking Amari headquarters this morning. I hope you're successful. I know what they've taken from you. Good luck. Kate.
David's mind raced. Would Kate do this?
Something felt wrong. We think she left several hours ago. I thought you should know.
I'm sorry, David. Howard walked to the door. David tried to analyze the tactical situation, tried to be objective. What am I missing? His mind kept flashing to Kate. Images of her from last night played through his mind like a slideshow he couldn't stop. She had been safe, and now she had delivered herself into the hands of his enemy. Why? It was his worst nightmare. Keegan gripped the door handle.
Wait.
David eyed him, thinking.
What option did he have?
I know where she went. Howard turned and looked at David skeptically. We were given a journal in Tibet. David dressed as he spoke. It contained a map of the tunnels below the rock. There's something down there. Something they need.
What is it?
I don't know, but I think she's gone after it. To use it to trade. What's our status?
Everyone's suiting up. We're almost ready for the assault. I need to speak with them.
30 minutes later, David was leading the final 23 clock tower agents in the world through the tunnels under the Rock of Gibraltar. He had told the men that he had to go, that he had to find Kate, and that he might be delayed in joining the assault. His role was largely ceremonial anyway. His wounds, especially the leg wound, disqualified him from playing an active role in the assault. He would be at a desk watching the screens and readouts, coordinating the men during the operation. His fellow agents had agreed unanimously. They would stay together, investigate the tunnels first, recover Kate, then resume the original plan. The boon from the chamber in the tunnels could offer some tactical advantage in the main operation. They had anticipated little resistance at the warehouse, and they weren't disappointed. The warehouses weren't even guarded, or locked, although they had been. The clock tower team found a common combination lock, the kind used on high school lockers, laying on the ground, snapped in half. Clearly Kate's work. Apparently Amari had abandoned the site a long time ago and regarded it as low value. The lack of security still made David suspicious. The entrance to the tunnels was just as the journal described it, and in almost the same condition. A black tarp had been thrown off the opening, and the lights leading into the mine were on. Inside the tunnels there was one change, an electric car system, like a monorail tram with single cars, had been added to provide swift, safe transport through the tunnels. Each car held two passengers, and the team piled into about a dozen cars, with Howard and David riding in the first car. After the dizzying spiral down into the mine, the tunnel straightened out and began forking. David hadn't anticipated this. He had assumed the Amari would have closed any dead ends. The map in the journal was of the inside of the Atlantis structure. He had no idea which way to go at the forks. There was no choice. Howard began dividing their forces, and unfortunately, the rail lines kept forking until David and Howard rode alone. Hopefully on the right track. The plan was to rendezvous at the entrance in 1 hour. That would still leave time for the pre-dawn raid at Amari Gibraltar. David stared straight ahead as the tunnel lights flew by in an endless monotony. What was he missing? Howard worked the car's controls, managing their speed. Somewhere, far off in the distance, three faint, rapid-fire pops rang out. David looked over at Howard, and they shared a knowing glance. Howard slowed the car, and they waited for more sounds, hoping to discern the direction.
"We can reverse," Howard said, quietly.
They waited. The tunnels were quiet.
What to do?
The sound was clearly gunfire. But David wasn't in fighting condition, and although Howard was in intelligence, he was a manager, not a soldier. Neither could offer any real resistance. In fact, they would probably be in the way.
"No, we go on," David said.
5 minutes later, they heard another bout of gunfire, but they didn't stop. 5 minutes after that, they reached the room that opened onto the Atlantis structure. The steps lay in the center of the room, fully uncovered. To the right was the jagged opening the journal had described. David could also see the rest of the structure, but it was mostly smooth, dark metal. Massive iron I-beams reached high overhead, holding the rock and sea at bay. David looked up, studying the area above the stairs. There was a huge dome, and a place where the structure's overhang had been cut away from above.
"What is it?" Howard said.
"This is where they extracted the bell," David said, almost to himself. Howard walked to the stairs, put his foot on the first step, and looked back at David. Without a word, David hobbled forward, moving up the stairs, leaning heavily on his cane. As he grimaced and climbed, an overwhelming sense of déjà vu engulfed him. The tunnel maker, Patrick Pierce, had also been lured down here under the guise of rescuing someone, only to be trapped himself. David crossed the threshold with Howard following closely. He stopped and studied his mentor's eyes. Was he missing something? What could he do about it now? Inside, the structure was illuminated with LED lights that ran along the floor and ceiling. The corridors were about 8 feet tall, not cramped, but not exactly spacious. They also weren't square. The bottoms and tops of the corridors curved slightly, giving it an oval shape, except the curves formed in sharper angles. Overall, the halls felt like the corridors of a ship, a Star Trek ship. David led Howard down the corridors, following the mental image he had formed of the map. Memorizing maps and codes was one of the quintessential tools of spycraft, and David was good at it. The structure was incredible. Many of the doors to the rooms were open, and as they passed by, David saw a series of makeshift labs, like something you might see behind the glass of a museum, where curators carefully studied or restored historical artifacts. Apparently, the Amari had dissected every inch of the structure in the past 100 years. It was surreal. David had only half believed the tunnel maker's tale, had thought that perhaps it was just that, a tale. But here it was. The false wall to the chamber was coming up, just around the next turn. As it came into view, David felt himself holding his breath. The chamber was open. Kate? Was she inside?
Kate!
David called out. There was nothing to lose. Anyone inside could hear his cane clacking on the metal floor from a mile away, so they didn't exactly have the element of surprise. No answer. Howard formed up behind him. David crept to the edge of the chamber's opening and peered inside. The room looked like some sort of command center, a bridge, with chairs dotted along smooth surfaces. Computers? Something more advanced? David moved into the room as carefully as he could. He pivoted around, leaning on his cane, scanning every inch of the room. "She's not here," he said. "But the journal, the story was true." Howard stepped inside the room and hit the switch behind him. The room to the door hissed closed, sliding from right to left.
"Oh, yes, it's quite true."
David studied him. "You've read it?" David again wrapped his fingers around the gun tucked in his belt. Howard's face had changed. His usually mild expression was gone. He looked satisfied,
confident.
I've read it, yes.
But just out of curiosity. I knew what it would say because I was there. I saw it firsthand. I hired Patrick Pierce to find this place. I'm Mallory Craig.
Chapter 110. Kate sat on the small plastic bench and stared at the white walls. She was in some sort of lab or research facility, but she had no idea where. She rubbed her temples. God, she was so groggy. Somewhere over the ocean, a man had walked back into the cabin and offered her a bottle of water. She had declined, and he had proceeded to hold her down and cover her mouth with a white cloth, the type that promptly induced unconsciousness. What had she expected? She stood and paced the room. There was a small slit in the white door, but the window revealed only the hallway outside and a few more doors like the one to her room. One of the long walls of the room had a rectangular mirror, recessed a few inches into the wall. This was no doubt an observation room, similar to the ones in her lab in Jakarta, except infinitely more creepy. She stared at the mirror. Was someone in there, watching her right now? Kate squared her body to the mirror and looked into it as if she could see the mysterious man behind it, her captor.
I did my part. I'm here. I want to see my children.
A voice broke over a loudspeaker. It was muffled and computer-altered.
Tell us what you treated them with,
Kate thought. She would have no leverage after she revealed what she knew.
I want to see them first. Then you release them, and I'll tell you.
You're not in a position to negotiate, Kate.
I disagree. You need what I know. We both know your drugs won't work on me. Now, you show me the children, or we've got nothing to talk about.
Nothing happened for almost a minute. Then on one side of the mirror, a video flickered to life. That part of the mirror must have been some sort of computer screen. The video showed the children, walking in a dark hallway. Kate stepped closer to the mirror, holding a hand out. Ahead of the children, a massive portal opened, revealing only darkness inside. The children walked through. The video paused with an image of the portal closing.
You've read the Tunnel Maker's Journal. You know about the structure in Gibraltar. There is a similar structure 20 times larger here. We think it's 8 times the size of Manhattan, almost 5 miles wide and 50 miles long. And it's 2 miles below us. It's been there, beneath 2 miles of ice, for countless thousands of years. The children are inside.
The screen in the mirror switched to a close-up image of the children before they crossed the portal. It zoomed in on packs the children carried. There was a simple LED readout, the type you see on alarm clocks, a series of digital numbers, a countdown.
The children are carrying nuclear warheads in those packs, Kate. They have less than 30 minutes left. We can deactivate them remotely, but you have to tell us what you did.
Kate stepped back from the mirror. It was insanity. Who would do this to 2 children? She couldn't trust them. She wouldn't tell them. They would only hurt other children. She was sure of it. She had to think. I need some time, she mumbled. The image of the packs disappeared from the mirror. A few seconds passed, and the door swung open. A man wearing a long black trench coat stepped robotically into the room and... Kate knew him. How could it be? Flashes of expensive dinners, her laughing as he charmed her, a candle-filled apartment in San Francisco, him unbuttoning her shirt, his head moving down her, kissing her stomach, a stomach without a scar. And the day she told him she was pregnant, the last day she ever saw him. Until now. Here.
You!
Was all Kate could manage. She stepped back as he marched into the room. Kate felt her back hit the wall.
Time to talk, Kate. And call me Dorian Sloane. Actually, let's dispense with the aliases. It's Dieter. Dieter Kane.
Chapter 111. Imari Tunnels, Gibraltar. David watched the man pace across the room, the man he had known as Howard Keegan, clock tower director, the man who now claimed to be Mallory Craig. You're lying. Craig hired Pierce almost 100 years ago. That's true, I did. And we've been looking for his journal almost as long. Pierce was an extremely clever man. We knew he sent the journal to the Amaru in 38, but we weren't sure it made it there. I was curious what he would say, how many secrets he would reveal. When you read it, weren't you curious about the deal he made with us? Why he stayed, working for the Amari for almost 20 years after the Spanish flu killed his wife and unborn child? What did he call it? His deal with the devil? The man laughed. David slipped the gun out of his belt. He had to keep him talking, at least a bit longer. I don't see what that has to do with you. Don't you? Why do you think Pierce would have worked with us? You would have him killed. Yes, but he didn't fear death. He read the journal's end. He would have welcomed it, would have killed us all in a blaze of glory. We had taken everything from him. Everything he loved, but his love for his child was more powerful than his hatred. As I said, Patrick Pierce was very clever. The second he emerged from the tube, he knew what they were. Hibernation tubes, suspension chambers. In that makeshift hospital in the warehouse above us, he made a deal. He would put Helena's dead body in one tube, and Cain would put Dieter, his dying son, in another tube. Both men became obsessed with medical research. They dreamed of the day they could open the tubes and save their loved ones. Of course, Cain's ideas were more radical, more radically charged. He became obsessed with finding a way to survive the bell. He took it to Germany, and you already know about the experiments. We knew Pierce was working against us, planning something. In 1938, on the eve of Cain's expedition, Cain had his stormtroopers capture Pierce and place him in a tube. Why not just kill him? We would have liked to, but as I said, we knew he had written a journal and that he was making other plans against us. We assumed the execution of those plans would be triggered upon his death, so we were in a tough position. Killing him was still too risky. Still, I laughed as Pierce fought with all his life until the guards incapacitated him and tossed him in the tube. Then, to my surprise and horror, Cain ordered the stormtroopers to put me in another tube. He didn't trust me, even after all my years of loyalty. Cain promised he would bring me back when he returned. He never dreamed he wouldn't return, but of course he didn't. We only found his sub a few weeks ago in Antarctica. And Pierce and I were woken up in 1978 in a different world. Our organization, the Amari, was practically gone. Only the shells of our corporations and certain overseas assets remained. The Second World War had decimated us. The Nazis had appropriated many of our assets, including the Bell. The Amari leadership, such as it was then, was desperate. Desperate enough to bring back the old guys, the people who had built Amari International in the first place. At least they had that much sense. But, of course, they didn't know all the history. Patrick Pierce and I were awoken at the same time, and we picked up almost exactly where we had left off. I set about rebuilding Amari, and Patrick resumed his role of thwarting me. I began by reviving the organization I founded, my division of Amari, the world's first global intelligence organization. You're familiar with it. Clock Tower, the Amari intelligence branch. You're lying. I am not. You know it. You saw the messages we sent in 47, the ones embedded in those New York Times obituaries. Why would Amari messages be marked with the words clock and tower? You had to have realized then when you saw the decoded messages, or perhaps even before. Somewhere in the recesses of your mind, you've known what clock tower was from the second you heard how many agents were under Amari control. You knew it when the cells fell so quickly. Think about it. Clock Tower wasn't compromised by Amari. It was an Amari division, a unit dedicated to gaining the trust of the world's intelligence bureaus, infiltrating them fully and ensuring that when the day came,
When we unleashed the Atlantis plague, they would be powerless, utterly blind. Clock Tower also serves one other purpose, to collect and contain anyone who was on to the Amari Master Plan. People like you. The entire time you've been at Clock Tower, we've been watching you, trying to find out how much you know and who you've told. It's the only solution. People like you don't break under interrogation. And there's another advantage. We've found that over the years, most agents join us when they learn the full truth. You will too. That's why you're here. To get indoctrinated? You think I'll join up if I hear your rationale? Things aren't as they seem. I've heard enough. David raised the gun and pulled the trigger.
Chapter 112. Amari Research Base Prism, East Antarctica. Kate shook her head. How could he be here? She wouldn't cry. All she could manage was, "Why?" Her voice cracked, betraying her. Dorian's expression changed, as if remembering something frivolous, a needless item he'd forgotten at the grocery store. "Oh, that. Just repaying an old debt. But that's nothing compared to what I'll do to you if you don't tell me what you treated those children with." He moved closer to her, forcing her into the corner of the room. Kate wanted to tell him now, to see the look on his face. "Cord blood." "What?" Dorian took a step away from her. "I lost the baby. But a month before I did, I had embryonic stem cells extracted from the umbilical cord, just in case the child ever developed a condition that required stem cells."
"You're lying."
"It's true. I used an experimental stem cell treatment on the children, using stem cells from the embryo of our dead child. I used them all. There aren't any more."
Chapter 113. Amari Tunnels, Gibraltar. David pulled the trigger again. Another click.
"I removed the firing pin," Craig said. "I knew you'd be able to tell the difference between a loaded and unloaded gun, so it was the best choice. And I needed to get you down here."
"Why?"
"I've already told you. I'm here to recruit you. By the time we're done talking, you'll know the truth, and you'll finally..."
"I won't. You can kill me now. I'd rather not, David. Good men are hard to come by."
"There's another reason. You know more than anyone else. You're in a unique position to..."
"You know why I joined Clock Tower. What the Amari took from me. What you took from me."
"Not me. Dorian. Dieter Kane. Granted, I used Clock Tower to make sure no intelligence agencies got wind of the plot, but he planned 9/11. It was his brainchild. He was obsessed with searching those mountains for his father. He desperately needed some kind of closure. It wasn't the only reason, as I said before. Our organization was in shambles when I awoke in 1978, and we were still recovering in 2001. We needed money, and a global cover to resume our work. Impossible. You expect me to believe that Dorian Sloan is Dieter Kane? It's true. When I awoke in 1978, I ordered his tube opened, and he walked right out, as healthy as could be. The tube must also be some sort of healing device, a medical treatment pod of some sort, but its powers are limited to treating the living. I watched as Patrick Pierce, who had been as stoic as a judge for the previous 20 years, crumbled into unimaginable grief as they pulled Helena's still dead body from the tube. He relived her death all over again. But medical technology had come a long way, and we were able to save the child inside her. His child? Daughter. But you know her already. Kate Warner.
Chapter 114. Amari Research Base Prism, East Antarctica. Kate studied Dorian's face. Confusion? Disbelief? Regret? He stared at the point where the wall met the floor, thinking. Then he focused on her, grinning an evil, unkind grin.
"That was very clever, Kate.
Of course you are very smart when it comes to science, but not when it comes to reading people. He turned away from her and paced toward the door. You're just like your father in that way. Brilliant, but foolish. What was he talking about? Her father died 28 years ago. Dorian, or Dieter, or whatever his name was. He was a madman. You're the only fool here, Kate said. Am I? All of this is your father's fault. He unleashed all of this. He killed my mother and brother and forced my father to undertake a risky mission to save the world, a mission from which he never returned. There's your why, Kate. I've dedicated my whole life to finishing my father's work and to righting the wrongs your father did to my family. And today, you've given me the keys to finally do that. Before Kate could react, an alarm rang out. A security guard or some sort of soldier burst in the door. Sir, we're under attack. Chapter 115. Imari Tunnels, Gibraltar. David's mind raced. He said his thoughts aloud, almost mumbling them. Kate Warner is Patrick Pierce's daughter? How? I thought new names were in order. If anyone ever connected us to the events during and after World War I, it would have complicated our lives. Pierce took the name Tom Warner and Catherine for his newborn daughter. He told her that her mother had died in childbirth, which was actually the truth. Dieter became Dorian Sloane, and he became obsessed with the past and his father's legacy. He was a hateful child. He had seen so much pain, and he was all alone in an age he didn't understand. Imagine a 7-year-old boy going to sleep in 1918 with the flu, when his parents and brother were alive, and waking up 60 years later. In 1978. Healthy and all alone in a strange world. I tried to be a father figure to him. But he was so troubled, so isolated. Like you, he dedicated his life to striking back at people who had taken the ones he loved, to killing the people who had changed him and ruined his life. For him, that was Tom Warner and the Atlanteans. Unfortunately for all of us, Dorian is very capable, and he had support within the Amari organization. To the Amari, he was the heir and savior returned, living proof that the plague and the bell could be beaten, that the human race could survive. It all went to Dorian's head. He grew into a monster. He's planning to reduce the human race to a select few, the genetically superior, what he believes is his tribe. He's already unleashed the plague. The apocalypse is happening now, as we speak. But we can stop him. You can kill him. Then I alone will run the Amari organization with you at my side. Craig watched David, hoping for some indication of how his former apprentice would react to the offer. I'll take you in as a prisoner. I know him. He'll want to gloat, to debrief and torture you himself. I'll give you a means to kill him when you're left alone with him. David shook his head. That's what you want? This whole charade? You want me to kill Sloane? To put you on the throne. Don't you want to? He was responsible for 9/11. He's your enemy. And you can save Kate.
She's there with him now.
He will hurt her. He hurt her before, in San Francisco.
The baby?
It was his.
What?
It was his revenge. With Tom Warner gone, that left his daughter. Dorian didn't hesitate. He wanted Kate to feel the pain he had, of awakening to realize that your family had been ripped away. He's a monster. Only Martin kept him from killing her. But Martin can't stop Dorian now. You can. You can save her. No one else is going to rescue her. Craig let the words sink in for a long moment, then turned and paced the room.
Think about it, David.
You know you can't win. You can't fight us. The gunfire in the tunnels, that was the sound of my Amari security agents killing the last of the Clock Tower loyalists. They're all dead. You're all alone down here. You can't defeat the Amari. No one can. The world is already fighting the plague. You can't prevent catastrophe. But we can change things. from inside Imari. We can shape the world to come.
David considered the offer, his own deal with the devil. Then he looked around the room for a weapon of some kind.